Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm your host Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 167, which is the second part of a two-part interview on the origins of teeth with Dr. Yara Haraday of the University of Chicago. So, the usual caveat with a two-parter, if you've not yet listened to episode 166, then you need to go and do that first. And it's absolutely worth your time doing so because you'll need that context to understand what's happening in this episode. So, as a recap, this is all about Yara and her colleagues examining the first evidence for vertebrates in the whole fossil record. Unfortunately, we don't have beautiful, fully articulated skeletons of the earliest jawless fishes, but we do have their odontodes. Now, these structures are essentially our teeth, and they're made of dentine and enamel, which are materials not known anywhere outside of vertebrates. So, if you found these structures, this material, then you've found a vertebrate. And they formed part of the external skeleton of these jawless fishes, and it's only millions of years later that these odontodes would migrate into the mouths of vertebrates alongside the evolution of the jaw, becoming the teeth we all hopefully still have today. So, by closely examining these odontodes, what can be learned about the earliest evolution of vertebrates? It's a simple enough research question, right? But what you're about to hear is anything but simple. Yara walks us through her discovery that not only turns everything on its head, but leads her down a totally different path that somehow comes full circle, allowing her to explain what odontodes were actually for. It's a wonderful story of scientific discovery, the importance of the scientific method, and the power of negative results. So this is another episode with a lot of terminology and a lot of new anatomy, so please make sure that you use our website where we've got pictures and some very useful diagrams that will help you understand what we're discussing. And I hope you all enjoy this research as much as I did, and if you do, then please help us share this episode with new audiences by engaging with this content on social media. I'm going to be trying out some reels or shorts or stories with this episode, so sharing those would be awesome, and if you're here listening to this because you actually saw one, then I'd really appreciate you letting me know. My next interview has been another that I've been chasing for a while, and I'm really excited to record it in just a few days, so hopefully I'll be back in a couple of weeks, and so until then, I hope you enjoy this episode. Yes, so all of this is just the context for looking for the first teeth. this is incredible, the amount of complexity, the number of people who are working on all of this. And so what then is the oldest evidence for odontodes or for dentine or for any sort of toothy stuff?
And so, great question. So, dentine, enamel, and bone are vertebrate exclusive tissues, as far as we know, in that we can't find them in any modern vertebrates. Their genetic networks are not found in genomes of other things that don't have them, unlike cartilage, for example. So, cartilage, we know obviously we have it. It's what makes our nose wiggly, it's what makes our ears wiggly. It's plenty in vertebrates, but it's also within invertebrates. So it's found in gastropods, it's found in annelids, it's found in squid. So cartilage is not a vertebrate exclusive tissue, but enamel, dentine, and bone are. And therefore, people really do look for it in early strata, in early rock, particularly within the Cambrian. So, because it would be a slam dunk that, that means we found the earliest vertebrate, right? So currently, right now, I guess I should... So before our paper, People had said that there's all these little fragments of things that could be vertebrate because they're phosphatic. So unlike a lot of invertebrate skeletons that are calcium carbonate, ours is calcium phosphate. And therefore, when people are doing screen washing or, you know, dissolving bulk material, if something weird and bumpy and phosphatic comes up, they are interested, right? They want to see if, hey, maybe this is the earliest vertebrate. So when people do that with Cambrian rock, there's all these little microfossils that show up and they pick through them and basically look for, hey, what could this possibly be? And so for a while, there's been all these little fragments that have been found in the latest Cambrian. People thought they were vertebrate, and there was a bunch of early papers that said, hey, we found the earliest vertebrates. And it really made sense because they're tiny bumps attached to phosphatic mineralized tissue. What else could they be? And then some people said, no, this doesn't look like vertebrate material. Again, I should actually like emphasize how tiny and fragmentary these bits are. They're at most maybe a millimeter or two wide. Very, very small. And so, you know, all these big wigs start arguing over very, very small fossils, as we tend to do. And initially, people were not so sure. And then people started using paleohistology. So they cut up some of these fragments. They looked at them with SEMs, scanning electron microscopes. And when you could see the internal structure really looked like teeth or odontodes in that it had a central cavity. It had a bunch of tubules coming from the central cavity, which is a marker of dentine. And then it had like sometimes a mineralized top layer, maybe not sure. So a lot of early literature said that there was some fragmentary vertebrates in the latest Cambrian. And so for me, that was super interesting because I was like, well, maybe there is something earlier than the Middle Ordovician ones that are well known, that have articulated material with a face and, you know, scales and recognizable fish parts. So I was really interested in these early fragmentary stuff.
It doesn't sound easy. It would be amazing, yeah, if we had, you know, just a fish and you could just point at this cordless vacuum and just be like, there you are, jawless fish, hello, covered in all of these odontodes. But no, we are just working with the fragmentary remains. And, you know, sometimes that's all you've got to work on. So, you know, the harder you look and you're looking at the smaller and smaller things, trying to see if it does fit, you can see why, but it doesn't make it any easier. And God, I can only imagine the arguments that go on within the early fish and teeth world. But yeah, what is the significance then? Because like, obviously we've got the oldest evidence potentially in the Cambrian. I mean, all it is it any more than just putting a date on when? Does it tell us anything?
Right. So the other problem with these early fragments is while they looked like other vertebrates, other later Ordovician ones, they were missing a few key parts. They didn't seem to really have a full enameloid or enamel covering, and their mineralized base that these little bumps were fused to was also different. So if that's truly the earliest odontode, and that's truly the earliest layers of bone, that would tell us the most primitive stuff didn't develop bone the same way and didn't have enameloid, which at least would give us some indication as to why one tissue evolved before the other. It had more implications than just a date. It actually had implications to the sequence of evolution of certain tissues. Because if you remember what I said earlier, where we have this big gap from squishy boys to fully mineralized things, people kind of are looking for that transitionary fossil of what evolved first. Did you really have to evolve things in sequence, or does it all happen at once? These are big questions in the early vertebrate world. So if these early fragments from the latest Cambrian truly were vertebrates, then it does say a lot about tissue evolution.
Yeah, it polarizes everything as like the very first data point. You know, you're looking for the earliest fish. If this is it, then it means that everything else that follows it has to go through this like evolutionary narrative through this first data point. And so, yeah, it has such a hugely significant position in the understanding of the evolution of all the vertebrates. Like, it is huge.
Exactly. In that, like, if you found the very first arthropod had like four heads, it'd be really weird. Be like, okay, well, now we have to know that everything after had to reduce heads or something. You know, for example, like you force all the other data through a kind of bottleneck because these early vertebrates would be so potentially influential to the entire story.
Okay, so what's controversial about it, though? Like, we're talking about something so incredibly specific, these like precursors to teeth in right. an exoskeleton of fish that are phosphatic. What else could it be?
Right. So, I mean, some really brilliant people, invertebrate paleontologists said that, hey, you know, it's not just vertebrates that sometimes phosphatize like mineralization. Every now and again, some arthropods do it, and some other invertebrates do it too. So that should be considered. And then, again, like some other brilliant scientists said, you know, this type of texture, this what vertebrate paleontologists assume is an odontode-specific texture, these bumps on a plate, also happens in a bunch of invertebrates. Surprise! Lots of their cuticle can be bumpy too, so let's not overlook that. And it's they were really great points made early on by paleontologists who pushed back and said, you know, you might be a hammer and everything looks like a nail. Let's look at it in a different light. And I really appreciate that pushback and them putting that into literature, because something like, I don't know, what is it now, 30 years later, 40, no more. Oh my God. 50 years later, I found those papers and I was like, oh, wait, this isn't settled. I don't have to just take this as fact that there is late Cambrian vertebrates. There is an alternative hypothesis out there. And so the alternative hypothesis out there was that they are invertebrates, that there's some sort of arthropod cuticle that was in the latest Cambrian. And that was kind of pushed aside as a hypothesis because another paper came out that brought forth the histology of these things, and the histology seemed to really look like an odontode. Again, pulp cavity, dentine with tubules. And so at that point, everyone kind of raised their hand and was like, okay, well, you know, unless we find something more articulated or more together, this has kind of stalled out. And this is where I felt like I could have some input, because I'm a histologist. My specialty was teeth and mineralized tissues. I had access to a synchrotron here at UChicago at Argonne. So I had basically a synchrotron in my backyard. And I was like, you know, technology's come a long way since this debate was last put to rest in 1996, I believe, was the last paper that came out about some of these fragments. And that's the one that said, hey, this looks like an odontode, this looks like a vertebrate, let's do it now in 3D. So that was kind of my pitch. So yeah, we took some of these fragments, we scanned them, and initially they really still looked like teeth. You know, they still looked like odontodes. They had all the structures that I associated with odontodes. I mean, even to me at this high resolution level, they still looked like odontodes. And then they had an upgrade to our synchrotron here locally, and I scanned them again, kind of just like for funsies. and the better resolution made me sweat a little bit, because not only did they look more complicated than odontodes in later taxa, we also decided, hey, let's be real scientists and have a control and scan some early like chelicerates, these arthropods, agilaspids. We were working with Javier and Karma from Harvard, and his specialty was adelospids. We found some that had phosphatized cuticle, and I was, you know, they did look like odontodes, but let's find out. So we scanned both of them, and they looked very, very similar.
Ooh. Yeah.
You know when you watch your like project kind of melt? You know when you see your hypothesis kind of just dissolve in front of your very eyes? Because I had pitched that I was going to get the very first 3D anatomy of the earliest tooth, right? That was like my pitch, and we were going to do it. I just watched it dissolve in front of my eyes. I was like, God damn it, these two are the same.
Wow. But that's how science works, you know?
A lot of it is accident.
Yes. Having to deconstruct everything that you think you know and reconstruct like what is going on. I think one of the things that I would like to know is you said about the possibility and you've compared it to an aglaspidid, which is sort of like half, it looks essentially like a trilobite with a tail. I think that's a good enough description at this stage. We did an episode with Javier, actually. I do not know what number that was, but someone's going to write it in the comments, or nobody's going to care. But anyway, they look like trilobite-y things. One of the first things I would say is, do you get them in the same formation, in the same rocks, side by side?
So you get them in many of the same rocks that some of the supposed Enatolepis, the supposed late Cambrian vertebrate, were found in. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you do.
That is a very first important piece of the puzzle, I think, that you can get them in the same place.
It's just that Enatolepis, those fragmentary phosphatic bits of the late Cambrian, you know, reported vertebrate, were found all over. And most of the time they were found from screen washing. And so people who were doing that were sedimentologists and biostratigraphers. They weren't necessarily doing full digs and looking for full head shields or articulated specimens. And in general, agalaspid full articulated specimens are not super common. You'll find fragmentary bits here or there. But if you're doing screen washing and you're dissolving bulk sample, you might be, you know, breaking them apart already. It's a very thin cuticle, as you can imagine. So there was a bunch of things that happened at the same time that I think made it completely reasonable for people to have overlooked it or not found. It's not like they were ignoring a fully articulated trilobite-looking thing and then finding fragments of what they thought was a fish right beside it. It's the collection method kind of masked some of the diversity that was happening there.
Okay. But we sort of have a match or, you know, like there's too many things that they have similar or how do you start disentangling it without, you know, being an expert in the cuticles and exoskeletons of both groups? Has anyone ever looked at this particular thing this closely before? Where do you start?
Yeah, I started with sinking into depression first. I cried a lot. Mostly because it was so out of my depth. I am one of the vertebrate people. I think all the tissues that I knew were vertebrate tissues. I did some research, obviously, and tried to find like published paleocuticle stuff, but it's just not as common. Histology and arthropod cuticles through the Paleozoic is just simply not published on very often, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So since I was looking to modern fish for other projects, I looked to modern arthropods as well. And that's when I realized that, you know, what you learn as a vertebrate person is that, oh, arthropod cuticles are simple and they're just layered things and vertebrates are the complex ones, but it's clearly very not true. And that's when I started learning about like grasshoppers and how they, you know, they need these tubules through their cuticle to release wax, to avoid desiccation. I learned about mollusk shells and a bunch of other things. I learned about a lot of modern inverts. And then we went through and collected a bunch of cuticles from modern living taxa. We did scorpions, we did horseshoe crabs, we did shrimp, we did other types of crabs, and we took them to the synchrotron as well so that we could be comparing at least at the same level of resolution. Because that's the other problem, is that when you're working at really, really tiny resolution, it's kind of like looking at things through a different lens. And so it's really hard to compare apples to apples, not apples to oranges, when not everybody has access to a synchrotron in the same way. So it's really hard to compare. But basically, we built our own comparative data set with modern taxa mostly, and some extinct. And then we were able to see like a huge diversity of really interesting structures that invertebrates build within their cuticle to solve their own problems, right? So they still need to sense their environment through a mineralized structure, and at the same time, occasionally throw it out and grow it again, which is just nuts. Ecdysis is crazy. Shedding is wild. I don't understand how you put all these sensory structures through a skeleton that you then throw out. So it was a big shift in thinking. Karma and Javier helped me a whole lot, at least by answering like my basic questions of like phylogeny of where do horseshoe crabs fit in, or you know, where do Eurypterids fit in? We were also able to get some Eurypterid cuticle from Utah. There's this one area where it preserves some. But yeah, it wasn't easy. It was a big shift for me. And like, I've done plenty of shifts within vertebrates. So like from mammals to reptiles, from reptiles to fish, from fish to like placid, you know, I've done a bunch of that, but at least, you know, vertebrates follow a rule book. A bone is a bone, and dentine is dentine, and enamel is enamel. And like I said, odontodes and teeth at least share a genetic network on how they develop. So there's a rule book. But when you go into invertebrates, they have no rules. They do everything. I mean, it explains a lot about their diversity, but they do a lot, and there's very little research in it. So it was very challenging, but incredibly rewarding and very interesting.
As someone who tried and failed to do a PhD on arthropod cuticles from the Paleozoic, I can completely agree what you've just said then. It is incredibly difficult. And I think that one of the biggest disappointments is in your paper and how it has been received, is that it doesn't celebrate or acknowledge the ridiculous amount of work that you have done to compare the exoskeleton of an arthropod to an odontode of a fish. Given that you had to first compare all of the arthropod exoskeletons just so you could say and like understand what they are and how they're made, just so you can say this one little fragment or these little fragments from the Cambrian, right, are they more like vertebrates or are they more like invertebrates and arthropods? The data and the comparative anatomy of cuticular microstructures, it's incredible.
Thank you so much. Nobody's
talking about that. That should be the first thing that they had in the news reports on this.
I know, right? But it's just hard to sell to people than, you know, sensitive teeth. They're like, hey guys, this person scanned a ton of scorpions. No, I obviously agree. It was a ton of work, and hopefully this big comparative data set can like be of use to others and future collaborations. And I'm incredibly thankful to Karma and Javier, who like were so helpful in this, particularly Javier, who already in his PhD was interested in cuticle ultrastructure of a glaspid. So he knew this like bumpiness of this cuticle was already really weird, and so that definitely started me off on the right foot. But like I said, there's just not enough literature. And then frustratingly, I'll just do this one plug here, but there was a really great paper that came out maybe a month after our paper was accepted. That is an amazing paper done by, I believe, Wong et al., where they do like cuticle ultrastructure of early Devonian arachnids, and it's beautifully done. And they find a lot of the same things that we did, but it came out like maybe a month or so after ours was accepted. And I was like, darn it. But it was really well done. I'm happy that people are starting to look at it. But before that, there isn't much.
Yeah, for sure. And it just shows like the ridiculous nature of the rabbit holes that you have to go down. we are trying to find the first teeth. And you've ended up having to scan, what was it, 45 different bugs, modern bugs. You do not anticipate that that is the route that you're going to go down. And so, all of that just to say, is this a fish or is it an arthropod? And in the end, it was...
an arthropod.
Yeah. So it's not even the first fish.
Nope. An Atalepis was definitely an aglaspid chunk, which is interesting because now we know a whole lot more about aglaspids. But in a really interesting way, I think, I mean, not to take away from the arthropod bit, because I do think that was, I mean, that's what led to everything and was the bulk of the paper. But I didn't even know what scincilla were. They're these like structures in cuticles of a bunch of different invertebrates, particularly in arthropods, that help them sense the world around them. They can be chemosensors, pressure sensors, mechanosensors. They're just a wild diversity of sensory structures. And because in the end of all of this, after sitting hours and segmenting all these structures and all these different arthropods, I was still angry because it still looked like a tooth. It still looked like an odontoad, even after all of that. It looked like a way more complicated odontoad, but it still looked very much like an odontoad.
Right. We need to separate the two investigative avenues here. Right. Let's finish off the fish first. It's not a fish. What is the first fish? What is the first odontoad and the first evidence of teeth that we now have in the fossil record? What is undisputed?
So it basically kicks it back to everything that we have from the Middle Ordovician. And so the Middle Ordovician, there's kind of a little bit of dispute about which one's exactly the oldest, but there's a bunch of stuff from Colorado and North America. There's some stuff from Bolivia and there's some stuff from Australia. But basically, generally, Middle Ordovician is now the confirmed earliest vertebrates.
And that's because we find these odontoads actually stuck on a fish's exoskeleton.
Right,
it has the eyes, it has the mouth.
Right. There is notable anatomy. There is more of them. So we're not just like messing around with one fragment. There's whole scales. And let me just clarify, it's the earliest evidence of a mineralizing vertebrate. Of course, before that, there's all kinds of squishy things that are still considered vertebrates.
Mm. Yeah, sorry.
No, it's all good.
So does that change the story? You know how, like we said earlier about it polarizing and it being this bottleneck in the narrative of the evolution of vertebrates and teeth and everything. How does that affect things? If we can discount everything that we thought was going on with Anatolepis.
I think it just takes... So what initially we thought maybe this is the transitionary fossil, maybe this is how simple bone looked, maybe this is how simple odontoads look. And if you kind of erase that chapter, we're back at square one. We're back at... there's a giant gap between non-mineralizing vertebrates, things like Pikaia, Metaspringia, all the squishy ones, and then our full-blown armored fish in the Middle Ordovician. So we're back to that gap. We're back to having already very differentiated, complicated tissues by the Middle Ordovician and no intermediate between. So I do believe that intermediate has to exist somehow, potentially in the late Cambrian, but we just have to be very careful as to what we interpret as vertebrate versus not vertebrate.
did you have to write like a funding report for this? So Yara, how did it go for your examination of the earliest vertebrates, teeth and all of that? And you'd have to write, well, the problem just still exists. It ended up that it wasn't. Sorry. No new information.
Sorry, we now just like arthropods. Goodbye. Yeah. luckily, I think we just had to write a report for the synchrotron facility, and they were just happy with the findings. They were happy that, you know, that they could demarcate one versus the other, and people like, you know, clarity and going back in a story and being like, oh, this was a misidentification, and this is why, and it actually led to bigger, you know, discoveries or in that kind of manner. But some people don't like negative results. I think this is as good as it gets with negative results. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so unfortunately we have to leave that question, but then the stuff that has come out of it, the stuff that you have discovered, it's incredible. And it's opened up an entire new, evolutionary story that you are now going down that you never thought you would ever be going down. This is breaking new ground. It's exciting. It's new stuff. Like, what kinds of things did we find out? And I'll split that up again into vertebrates and to invertebrates. So when you were looking at odontodes, mm-hmm. in the context of this study, did you find anything new out about them from what you were able to see when you looked at the modern ones and when you looked at the ones from the Ordovician? Mm-hmm. What more do we know about them now?
So I'm going to answer that in a little bit of a roundabout way. I'm going to go back to the arthropod part of it, because I said, like I said, this is a arthropod heavy paper. And just because I discovered that these bumps are clearly arthropod in origin, and yes, it's not a fish, it's probably some chunk of an agalaspid, I still wasn't completely satisfied, because as I said, like, I thought it still looked like a tooth. And so I wanted to know, what are they on arthropods? What function do they have on arthropods? And, you know, modern arthropods gave the answer of their sensilla. And once I found that out, then I was like, well, you know, there's that floating hypothesis around about the origin of odontodes and what their early function might have been, that it might have had a sensory function. And Neil Shubin, who's on the paper and my supervisor here at UChicago, was all about this idea. He's like, you know, I bet you it's sensory. A lot of like early innovations have to do with sensory systems. I bet you it's sensory. And that theory made sense, except that we didn't have the data for the modern fish. We didn't have the data on modern taxa that have odontodes and if they're actually sensory. Because there's also a theory or an idea generally that teeth became sensitive once they entered the mouth as part of a sensory feedback for chewing, right? You don't want to break your teeth by chewing too hard, or by actually knowing that something, you have something in your mouth. Maybe that only happened once they had a chewing function. We don't know if they had any sensitivity outside the mouth. And so this was something that had to be tested. And I couldn't find anywhere in literature if odontodes are innervated like our own teeth, which is bizarre. It seems like such a basic anatomy question. Are there nerves going to shark odontodes? Are there nerves going to catfish odontodes? And I couldn't find anything in literature. I asked a bunch of experts and they're like, oh, I'm sure they're innervated, but like we couldn't find a single paper that did it.
Is this going to end up with you scanning all of the odontodes of modern fish?
Worse. Unfortunately, so much worse. I had to learn how to clear embryos. So first I bred my own catfish because they were easier to breed in lab than sharks. Sharks are notoriously difficult to breed in lab, and we just don't do that. So we ordered shark embryos, but to also have another comparative, I bought like sucker mouth catfish from a pet store and started breeding them. So sucker mouth catfish are like what everyone puts in their tank to eat the algae off their aquarium. And so those are the ones we got in lab. They breed like bunnies. I was lucky enough that that worked out pretty well. But it was my like first aquarium. I never kept fish before. And so then we bred the catfish and looked at their odontodes in the embryos because they're easier to image. And so we use this like particular protocol where you clear the tissues of these animals. Basically, there's a way to make them see through, and you bathe them in antibodies that attach to nerves. And this antibody is attaching to nerves on one side and then has a fluorescence on the other side. And so it basically makes all the nerves on this animal glow under confocal microscopy. So I had to gain a bunch more skills to understand the vertebrate side of this. And at a certain point, I was like, this probably should be a separate paper. But in the end, we squished it all together, and I'm happy that we did.
And hang on, you've also got the catfish husbandry skills, and you've also now probably got an aquarium at home.
Yes, definitely.
This is going in so many different directions. All we wanted to do was find the first teeth, and now you've got an aquarium.
Yeah, I know, right? And a weird collection of a bunch of like scorpions and not live ones, but like in jars and stuff. I had to, you know, collect a bunch of those. So yeah,
I've got them all downstairs. I'm exactly the same. I've just got boxes of bits of tarantula and bits of scorpion.
You never know when you need a bit of tarantula.
Anyway, it's another whole. I mean, this could be a project in and of itself, and all we're trying to do is just look at what Anatolepis was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, in the end, I was still very interested in why odontodes existed, and if this tangent of us figuring out that it's not a vertebrate, but it's an arthropod, could give us an interesting kind of roundabout clue as to a weird, really, really disparate convergence, right? So like once animals mineralize their skeletons, they still have to see the world. They still have to feel the world. They still need to sense past that mineralized skeleton. And these early vertebrates had a really thick exoskeleton. So in some ways, arthropods and these early mineralizing fish were kind of facing similar problems, right? They were both in the ocean trying to, you know, find food but not get eaten. And so how do you do that? Maybe you solve that in the same way. You cover yourself in little sensitive bumps and you try to get food and not get eaten. It's really interesting and remarkable convergence. Because like I said, even after I knew it was an arthropod, it still looked like an odontode.
Yeah. And I've always described it as like in an arthropod, every single interaction you have with your whole world, the ecology, happens through its exoskeleton. Mm-hmm. It tastes, it sees, it feels, everything goes through that. It's like, I don't know, what am I thinking? I'm just looking at the car park, just being in a car. Mm-hmm. Like when you're in a car, you can't feel the outside world. Yeah, you can see it and maybe hear it, but you can't like feel the wind rushing mm-hmm. against you because you're inside, you're protected. Mm-hmm. So how do you understand what's going on the outside? I mean, your car's got a thermometer in it, so you can see what temperature it is at the outside. It also has a speedometer, so you know how fast you go in, mm-hmm. and all of that kind of information is you get from through the exterior of the car. Mm-hmm. That's a terrible analogy, but
I get what I mean. It holds up. It's working. Yeah, it's working through this armor. How do you do it?
And so, yeah, with aglaspidids and mm-hmm. and then with these odontodes, they are feeling their world.
Yeah, but, I mean that's our hypothesis based on modern fish. So, like I said, I grew all these catfish and these sharks, and we found that they had nerves going to these odontodes. And so if you have nerves going to a system and all the parts are there, the same dentine, the same enamel, we know our own teeth are incredibly sensitive. It might explain some of that.
So could you say that your jawless fish were feeling the world through their exoskeletons by what is essentially toothache?
Yeah, I basically in the press releases and stuff, we've been saying like you can blame these ancient fish for your overly sensitive teeth. If you have a toothache, blame your fishy ancestors.
That's incredible.
But then, it's weird, right?
What I find most incredible is the convergence. Okay, so you've got these two different groups. They have their own exoskeletons formed in their own different ways, each with their own different minerals and their own structures, but they have come up with a solution to feeling through their exoskeletons that are so similar in the way that they're constructed that you for as long as we've known what a Natalepus was, like we had them mixed up. Mm-hmm. Just because they're just essentially identical.
Yeah, they're incredibly similar. I mean, like I said, even at our first low-resolution scans, I still thought it was an odontoad. It's kind of similar to, like, you know, eyes evolved multiple times, but in many ways, they're very similar. Even if you look at them in cross-section, right, there's a lens, there's an area that receives light, there's a way that nerve transmits the light to information to the brain. In the basic structure, they can look incredibly similar. Even, you know, things in, I just scanned a jumping spider recently and their eyes are so wild. But in the end, if you just break it down to its component parts, it's incredibly similar to some vertebrates. And yet they came up with that solution in many ways independently.
It's incredible. I see it as like they have the exact same thing, the exact same issue, the exact same problem they were trying to address. And they've seemingly just copied each other's homework.
Yeah, pretty much.
So what can we do with this? Like where does this go next? Are there any like avenues that you can explore with how they are similar and how sensory ecology and sensory exoskeletons work? What's next?
So for me, I think what's next is a few things. One is I have a lot of people who are arthropod researchers now reaching out and being like, how can we do this with our stuff? Which is really great. So I'm showing a few people, like I said, I just scanned the jumping spider. We're doing some stains and stuff to look at cuticles in those. But for me, particularly for my own research, I'm still looking for that transitionary vertebrate. I still think it has to exist somewhere. It just might not look like what we think it will look like. So I'm going to do field work. I'm looking for more at the base of the tree at that transitionary time for mineralized structures. We're also still doing more work with catfish and sharks and trying to really understand what kind of sensory information they're collecting from these odontoads. Is it actually exactly the same as our teeth? So just because they're innervated doesn't necessarily mean they're communicating the same things. Is it a pressure receptor? Is it a chemoreceptor? Is it a temperature receptor? These are all things we still don't know. So my research has... still going to lean on the vertebrate side, but I have a lot of new collaborations with people who are looking at arthropod anatomy, which is very exciting.
It's such a wonderful story, I think, of just the crazy places that you end up. I think it's so good to be able to talk about this and to show everyone just like the processes behind it, because hardly any of this is like even in the paper as well. Like,
I know, it's short.
Like, it's really short, but I guess that's just, was it Nature that it was in?
Yeah.
Just the way that it is. And a lot of the detail of what you did gets pushed into the, like, the bit of the paper that's, like, kind of attached at the side as like an optional. Yeah. If you really want to know, here's what we actually did.
Yeah, I really appreciate you giving me this like long format platform, because it's really hard to tell people, like, get to basically let people into my brain and be like, and this is why we did this, and here's this rabbit hole, and then that's how that rabbit hole allowed this next rabbit hole. And you know, it's really hard to explain to people how wild it's been to go from, now I have to read about scorpions in the morning and then go feed my catfish in the afternoon, you know. Really hard to explain to people that is really odd for me, but it's been fun, and I appreciate your patience in going through like all these different rabbit holes with me.
A one sentence summary of your paper. We looked to see if this was the earliest odontodes. It wasn't. That's what it could be summarized as.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
doing so, you lose so much of the story.
I know, right? Yeah, I think that's only a small part of the paper, really. And it's just, I do realize that not everyone approaches their studies this way, but I think we can understand so much from negative results, especially why we were wrong, right? So like, for example, like I said, I kept thinking, all these people who came before me, who worked on Anatolepis, and those who doubted Anatolepis, those who thought they were arthropods in the first place, both those groups of people were brilliant scientists. Why did they make that mistake? That's not a minimal mistake to make, right? They know their anatomy. They know their animals. There is something there. There is more. That deep convergence was really intriguing to me. And I kept digging until I was satisfied with the answer.
Oh, what a story. So for anyone that is considering this problem, this area of research, what you can do when you do comparative anatomy, comparative histology, comparative all of these things, sensory ecology, there's so many different like bits of paleontology in here. Mm-hmm. If anyone's interested, is there room for more researchers? Is this an area of paleontology that has plenty of growth for new students and new people asking questions?
Absolutely. There's so much space. Like I said, there's barely any work done in this area, and that's why I had so little reference literature and had to like go collect my own. There's so much room for sensory ecology. And the new technology is allowing like really more interesting questions to be asked. There's, you know, all of a sudden in this past couple of years, we've had the very first preserved brains on the vertebrate side for fish with like structures, which is amazing. I didn't even think that was possible. And then the same thing is happening with arthropods. There is now preserved central nervous systems in Ordovician arthropods. So this is just starting. I think this is going to be the new like big field in the next coming 10 years or so. Just people reanalyzing old specimens and being interested in how these creatures perceived their environment and how that sequence of evolution for that perception has happened. There's so much to be done. And my only piece of advice is like to know your own biases. It's difficult. And collaborate with people that are not from your particular subfield, and then sample wide in taxonomy and sample deep in time. I think that would be the best piece of advice I can give.
Right. Well, this has been a huge adventure in paleontology, and I'm feeling absolutely inspired. And I just want to go and synchrotron all of the exoskeletons.
Scan all the arthropods.
I think you've done most of them now, haven't you?
No, absolutely not. There's so many. Oh my god.
There are quite a few arthropods out there, so we don't have to worry about that just yet. Yara, thank you so much for coming onto the show and speaking us through it all. It's an incredibly complicated subject, and I have loved every moment of it, and I think it's all come across really well, so I'm so glad we did this.
And thanks so much for having me on and talking about sensory structures.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Liz Martin-Silverstone, Tom Fletcher, Nick Lupshire, Emily Keeble, and Sophie Pollard. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, our listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where you'll gain access to additional multimedia content. And thanks to everyone who's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.